funny and optimistic and quite tender things that happen in these women's lives. But the sentence that was the problem, I mean, a lot of people thought that I was making a statement there that women artists despise men. And this seemed to me a very crude interpretation of that part of the story. But the problematical sentence is, we've done something to ourselves so that men won't do it. And somebody asked me, or a lot of people have asked me, what I meant by so that. Did I mean in order that? Or did I mean in such a way that this is the result? And I didn't know. I realised when I'd written the story, I didn't know precisely what I meant by that sentence. And if challenged on it, I would have had to do a hell of a lot of thinking. Well, I mean, I've done it anyway, but it was a bit late because the story had already been published. But when you ask about the life of art, I suppose, yeah, now that I've said all this, perhaps I'd have to say I do. But in a sense, it's a very pessimistic story about the possibility of women fulfilling themselves and yet being able to be with a man in any way that isn't exploiting the man or the woman being exploited by the man. It is a problem. But I would hate to think of this as being seen crudely as a feminist story.
I'd like to say something about that, the feminist thing too. You say that you don't like to call yourself a feminist writer. Mm. And similarly, I mean, I don't like to promote myself as a feminist writer because I don't like hanging labels on what I write and imposing another sort of rules to operate within. Everybody has... it means different things to different people, so they're expecting you to operate within their rules, how they understand it, and this is very restricting, I find. But it's very interesting, this sort of piece that you read out, which is about the relationships between people and all these little permutations, which I love to write about, and I enjoy, for instance, writing about... guilt, women's guilt. Women are very good at guilt, but I'm not allowed to do that anymore because women, of course, are now, they're strong and without guilt and they can do anything. And so it's very difficult for me. On the other hand, of course, men are now becoming a bit guilty, so I can write about guilty men. Yes, I haven't really done that yet, but it's a thought. Or perhaps I have done it, actually, and I did set one of my novels from the male point of view entirely. And what do you feel about this crossing the gender gap thing? Have you done that? Have you written from a man's point of view?
Yeah, I have.
Don't you?
Yeah,
in a story.
Yeah, in a story, in a couple of stories. But I find it quite a challenge, really. But I suppose that any artist has obviously got some large area of himself or herself, which is sort of androgynous. I mean, I think everyone does anyway. But the only way you can, I don't want to feel trapped inside myself. In fact, I think that's one reason why. That's one thing that I'm trying to. I saw something yesterday about somebody had written about a painter, and they'd said one abstracts in order to generalize, and I was struck by that because to me, I'm sort of sick of the so-called domestic realism that people describe me as writing. I'm sick of being stuck in realism. And there must be a way to crack the surface of it and get... I don't mean by... You see, for a long time I thought, God, my subject matter is so narrow and et cetera, et cetera, the usual stuff. But I thought, well, I just couldn't imagine myself writing a huge novel about... three generations of a family, even, which seems to be what everybody does these days, or something set in a country where I didn't really know what I was talking about. But I realised that my problem isn't subject matter so much; it's particularity. I think that. Do you feel that too?
Yes,
the feeling of like us, but it depends why you write something, I suppose. When I started to write, I was writing just because I was. I just wanted to tell what I knew and say what I'd seen around me, and people tend to like that, and especially in a place in smallish cultures like this one and Australia, I think people want to have their lives sort of validated in some way by their artists. But the trouble with being a novelist or a short story writer is you can get really stuck on the upper levels of that kind of writing. So I'm interested in technical things, really, and in psychological depths and structures that, structures of on which I can build stories that will give the story some kind of resonance and strength. That I mean, even in that novel, The Children's Bark, I tried to write that in a contrapuntal gilding the lily a bit, but it's like a lot of voices crossing over each other as they do in music, and I hoped that that structure would somehow strengthen the novel rather than having to depend on the strength of the characterisation or strength of narrative. There must be some other device seems too trivial a word, but I think that there are certain objects that can be emblematically charged in writing, and there are also last year I sat down and read the Bible from front to back, and of course all English writing is deeply imbued with the imagery of the Bible, and I realised that it was possible to draw on that fact in a strengthening way, in the way I'm talking about, in that there are our whole language, our whole poetry is filled with ideas that come particularly from the Gospels, I think. For example, even in that story that I read about the wedding, I don't notice this happening until afterwards, but there are all sorts of things like saying that somebody shows his palms. And of course, as soon as you pull that out of the story and point it out and use it in the same paragraph, in the same sentence as anything to do with the Bible, you think, oh, geez, that's overdoing it a bit. But there, you can use little structures, like, for example, people doing things in threes. And I've just written a rather gruesome story about a cremation. And I wanted somebody to betray someone after they'd died. And I had this boy sitting in the garden, and he was being questioned by someone about a girl, his girlfriend, who just died. And he betrays her. And as I started to write this, he pretends that he didn't know her. And as I started to write this, I thought, ah, yeah, I see what this is. This is what happens in the gospel when St. Peter betrays Jesus three times. I'm not suggesting that what I'm talking about is as important as that story, but the structure of the story, if I can make that treachery happen three times and then a bird sings in the garden, somewhere dimly in people's mind is the echo of that mighty story of the gospel, but the structure of it will send a sort of a shudder up through my story. And I used to feel that it was a cheek of me to do that, that it was impertinent. But now I feel it's almost my duty to do that, or else I'm being... cowardly. Do you see what I mean? Yeah. I mean, this stuff's there. It's there to be used. It's in us anyway. So why not strike a note of it?
I think I've struck some notes, but I'm remembering a story that I have written, which, when I think about it, has these kind of biblical uses. But and this social, at least this domestic realism charge bothers me a little bit too. I mean, I think it's that labels are such dangerous things anyway. And I think just because you write, say, about the home, you don't have to write realism precisely. You can then give it a sort of a...
surreal.
well, yes, and a twist and... some of the things I write are just straight domestic realism, or have been. But my first novel, for instance, I can remember the word bizarre kept cropping up in reviews all over the place. And I like to bring in something a bit bizarre, give a little twist, not at the end, but, you know, as one does in a short story or used to. But all the way through, you know, just give it a sort of
tilt,
atmosphere of menace or a slight tilt, yes. And I think you can do that. You don't have to be flat. The trouble with labels, it's a bit like names. I remember there was a girl at school who was very strange looking and very fat, and I think she was called Brenda. In fact, I know she was called Brenda. And so any time I hear the name Brenda, I think, oh. And, you know, the same thing happens to the way that you label things. You think of the domestic realist novel perhaps as a novel that you read and hated, and so you don't like domestic realism. It's dangerous.
Well, Marilyn, I know you've been asked this before, but I think people here will be interested. After such early success, you seem to have a long period of writer's block. Was this due to a block or was it merely domestic busyness? And what caused you to stop and what caused you to start again?
Well, there was, I think, 14 years when I wasn't actually producing a novel. And it was. It was to do with life taking over and children. And I was being a single parent for quite a lot of the time, being and supporting my kids for some of that time. So this was the real reason. I started writing novels, but a novel is a very long work, and it requires, you know, a lot of space in your head, which you don't get when you're being a mother of young children, and also an earner. So yeah, that was the real reason.
And Helen had a lesser period. Was there some reason for that? Were you involved in writing scripts and things? I know you acted as well in films, didn't you?
Well, why did I stop? Couldn't think of anything to say. I think that was why.
Yes.
I had to make a living by other means. And I had a few sort of personal catastrophes that probably made it rather difficult. But I think it was also somebody rather bluntly put it outside of who I was talking to a moment ago, that it's really just midlife crisis that's happening to me. And I feel dissatisfied with things that I've done, and I'm trying to find a deeper point in myself to write from, I think. And you can't just do that by willpower. Mm. Something has to happen and you have to sort of go with it, I think. So, I think that's probably why. I did actually write two movies in the meantime, but that's...
Just tossed them off. Okay, shall we have some questions from the floor? If you'll just raise your hand and someone will bring a microphone to you.
Here's one. Over here.
Marilyn mentioned that one of your stories was you were asked to speak about it as a feminist story, and you didn't realize, but they were paying you money, so you went along. And your artist friend is talking about doing violent paintings because that's what will make them sell. And you've both mentioned how you react to what critics say about you and being pigeonholed and bizarre, and you'd like to be bizarre because critics have mentioned it, or you don't want to be pigeonholed into being domestic realist or whatever. And my question is, how important at all, even if it's subconscious, is your having to be commercial? How much of that enters into your writing, your ideas? Do you stay away from things or attack things because of how they may be perceived commercially?
Well, what I would say is that while I'm writing, I'm not aware of being commercial at all. It's afterwards. I'd written that novel, you see, that I was going to talk about, so it didn't really matter. I wasn't going to alter what I'd written by going and talking about it. But money, of course, is tremendously important to writers because they don't get a lot of it. So, the subject does come up from time to time. But no, it doesn't affect what I write. Not enough.
No, I don't think I've ever thought about it. Because I make money out of journalism a bit. And then, I, of course, I could think about it, about that. I don't... I mean, if I were thinking commercially, I would be doing something quite different. It's possible to make money out of film. It's a very different kind of writing. And in that sense, of course, you... I think it was Tam Janowitz was saying yesterday, you've got so much less control over what happens to the work that the other people's demands impinge on you a great deal more. But with writing fiction, I suppose you're really quite free. You're about as free as you could get. Unless you were trying to make, to live on that totally, which would be suicide in Australia anyway.
I was just wondering about the beginning, for instance, to Disorderly Conduct, where Sophie jumps into a car and rushes out to meet her lover halfway between their two houses. And I have wondered if a publisher says, come on, Marilyn, we need a good zingy opening to this, or, you know, it'll be more commercial. Or
well, publisher doesn't say anything very much, or didn't then, because I didn't have a publisher. I mean, that was after a 15-year gap. I just, it's just what you do. I mean, I think I'm aware of the fact that openings are important and that I do want to grab my reader. At that point, I am aware that there are readers out there beginning to read me, but then I forget all about them. You know, by about the third page, they've gone. Thank goodness.
I wonder if Helen Garner could give us some idea of the problems and the limitations or constraints involved in writing a film script.
Yes, I could. Well, I'm in a funny position. My first novel was made into a movie, but the screenplay was written by someone else. I didn't have anything to do with it. The second film that had to do with me was the one I mentioned yesterday, which is Two Friends, directed by Jane Campion. And I learned an enormous amount from working with her. She was wonderful to work with. She was, and I had a terrific producer too, a woman called Jan Chapman, an Australian. And I mean, I didn't know how to write a film. I've seen a lot and I love films, but I found them marvellous to work with because they were quite demanding with me and ask me a lot of difficult questions. See, the thing about writing a novel is you sit in a room by yourself for 2 years and slog away, and if you're like me, you don't show it to anyone until you get to the end. And so all the faults are sort of embedded in the structure by the time you hand it over. But with film, it's awful. It's a nightmare. It's in a sense, it's very good for me because you can't be precious about it. There's someone breathing down your neck the whole time, and you have to account for yourself at every stage. And also, it's never finished. I mean, you can't finish it because all you're doing really is mapping out the territory and putting in what, you know, you make the characters and the situation and the dialogue. But the way a film looks and the pace at which it moves is going to be controlled by somebody other than you. So you have to hand the thing over while it's still in a fairly molten state so that the director hasn't been, so the director doesn't have to sort of chip her way through layers of finality to get to the thing to use it. It's a sort of a blueprint that you're making, really. And I wrote a third film, which is I actually had a strange experience with this one. The ABC commissioned me to write this thing, and you do it draft by draft. It's in three drafts, and you have a separate contract for each draft so that either side can bail out at any point before they've done their money. And so I handed in the three drafts. They paid me the full sum. And then there was an enormous silence which lasted for a year. And the person in charge of the film, the feature film unit at the ABC, just wouldn't read it. It would have taken her an hour to read it, but for some reason she, I think it was probably because she and my producer were at loggerheads and she didn't want to give her the satisfaction of reading something that she'd commissioned. But I had a contract which gave them an option on it for a year, and after a year their option was over, and I was able to try and sell it somewhere else. So that's what in fact has been done, and it's now they're talking about millions of dollars, and I still haven't seen any more money. But it's a very strange and cloudy area, film. I think you'd have to be very passionate about it to want to do that as your number one sort of string. I don't think I could bear it.
Well, I think we more or less have to close there, unless there are any more urgent questions. So thank you all very much for coming, and thank you very much, Helen Garner and Marilyn Duckworth. Thank you.